So we have about 30 minutes or so for comments and questions, and the floor is yours. Just please tell us your name and where you're coming from, literally, what part of the university or community you're coming from, or what part of the world.
I'll start.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm from Myrtle Heights, and I just came without knowing what kind of event this was, and now I'm really glad that I came. I'm a sophomore at BC. I'm originally from Korea. I live in LA, and I'm studying here Russian here, and I was really into the orphanage system in Russia to like US, and but recently Vladimir Putin like outlawed all the orphans coming to US from Russia. So I was really like stuck. I didn't know where to go from here. So what kind of advice would you give me? Like, where should my next step be? Like, I wanted to go study abroad in Russia, but I can't anymore because it's external and a lot of problems entail external programs. So I just gave up. So where should I go next?
Yeah, I had a really similar experience to you. One thing that a lot of people at the university don't realize is that external programs, financial aid doesn't apply towards external programs at BC. And interestingly, a lot of the external programs are the programs that are in the developing world or in sort of non-traditional study abroad countries. So if you are a financial aid student, you can study practically anywhere in Western Europe, but you can't go to Turkey, you can't go to Russia, you can't go to India or Vietnam. This is a huge problem, I think, for the university. I think the student body is, at least in my experience, is sort of at the cutting edge of being interested in a variety of different global issues. But in an area such as study abroad, the university is a little bit stuck in terms of developing internal programs in the developing world, especially in countries in the Middle East and North Africa, and actually just in Africa, period. I personally had been very interested in studying in returning to Tajikistan, but it was an external program. So I sort of, like you said, gave up on the idea. So I think that's a huge challenge. I think that young people at BC need to play a greater role in terms of how we advocate for the changes that we want to see in the university. I know that the core process is ongoing, and a variety of different things. And I wonder whether we are really an activist student body when it comes to our own educations. I hear a lot of students express frustration that certain languages aren't offered at the university. Personally, being in the political science department, I often lament the fact that there aren't really political science teachers that that focus on Southeast Asia, on Africa. We just hired a professor that for the first time someone is going to teach about South Asia. I mean, these are countries with huge populations that are going to be very influential in the future, but there aren't a lot of opportunities at BC to study them sort of formally. Although, that being said, there are opportunities like those of you that have participated in the advanced study program that can supplement your education in ways in which, if for those of you that are interested in addressing things that aren't necessarily offered formally. Also, the language laboratory is a wonderful resource for studying non-traditional languages that Boston College just doesn't have the capacity to offer. We're also in a consortium where you can take classes at universities such as BU, which I know we don't like to talk about that as BC students, but they actually have a lot of classes that we just don't offer. Last semester, I took a class on Persian epics in Farsi at BU, and even though I hated writing the tea every morning on Tuesdays and Thursdays, it was well worth it. And that's something that you can do for free as a Boston College student amongst five universities. A little bit of initiative and creativity can really go a long way in terms of creating the opportunities for you that you don't see for yourself. I've been a guinea pig for a long time. This wasn't the first year that was the case. I was the first person to ever participate in the program that I did in India. I was the first person to participate in a program to Senegal. I didn't mention that. I think I mentioned the UN delegation that I went on to Iran. they weren't about to bring a young person on that delegation without the persistence that I brought to wanting to participate. I mean, I was 18 years old. I think it was really crazy of the head of the delegation to take on the liability of taking an 18-year-old to Iran. I greatly benefited from that. And to be honest, I think it's often the adults that had some sort of mentor that gave them opportunities that they weren't particularly qualified or prepared for that really tend to extend these types of opportunities to other young people. In this case, the head of the delegation to Iran had come to the United States after the revolution in Iran, and he was interested in film, but he had zero money in his pocket. And so he went to USC Film School, and he knocked on the door of the dean's office of the film school, which, as you know, USC Film School is one of the greatest film schools in the world. And he said, "Well, I'm past the application deadline, and I don't have any money, but it would really be a mistake not to accept me into the film school." And the dean was so struck by his sort of pluck, I guess, that he was accepted. And now he, before he passed away last year, he was a really extraordinary Iranian-American filmmaker who was taking Americans to Iran when that was seemingly impossible to do. So there's a lot of possibilities in terms of creating your own path.
Yes.
Hi, my name's Rachel. I'm from Australia. I'm studying for the spring semester at BC. And a couple of my friends have actually been Australian youth delegates. Mm-hmm. Mentioned Dan a couple of years before. We've had the program for many years. Given that you are this guinea pig figure, where do you see your program going? Like in Australia, we have this established listening tour, as you mentioned, that Dan went on, where I've been visited on the listening tour myself, like as somebody that's been involved in NGOs. Like, where do you see the future of the program going?
You've sort of alluded to the democratic element that doesn't exist currently in the US youth delegate program. I think, I personally didn't participate in a listening tour for a variety of reasons.
You couldn't fit it in that 3-hour span?
Yes. there was the 3-hour span. The experimental nature of the program. I've heard a lot of really interesting stories from people at the State Department of all the sort of disaster scenarios that they had gone through, of what I might do, you know, on the floor of the UN or something, all the international incidents I could have caused, things like that. Although I'd like to think that I'm more mature than a lot of delegates that I've seen do particular things at the UN that I think were very responsible. But that being said, I think definitely the listening tour element, making young people in the US feel like this is a role that represents them and their interests, that they can interact with me. It's very challenging to be a full-time student at BC with a full-time job and also being a full-time youth delegate. so that's, you know, I have personal limitations. But also, I mean, the amount of financial resources that have been put into my role have actually been quite substantial, given the fact that this is the first year of the program. I'm in March, I'm going over spring break for a week to Geneva to represent the U.S. at the UN Human Rights Council. So we're building little by little. We would be very lucky if our program was as developed in the next few years as the Australian Youth Delegate Program is. It also depends a lot on domestic institutions for youth development. For example, a lot of Western European countries have the advantage of having a youth council program where they already have established points of youth participation in governments. There's a student at Harvard who's the U.S. Youth Delegate to UNESCO, who was appointed by Secretary Clinton, who currently has gotten 6 senators to sign on to a bill to create a presidential youth council that would advise President Obama on a variety of different youth issues in the U.S. And I'm very proud to say that one of my senators from Washington has signed on to the bill. So has Scott Brown, interestingly enough. It's really come a long way. As was mentioned, I was initially called the Youth Observer, and some of you probably wondered why they gave me such a embarrassing name like that. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that people just, they weren't ready to have youth, be, a young person be an official part of the delegation. But that's changed over time, and now everyone calls me the youth delegate, and the other youth delegates have stopped making fun of me for being the youth observer. Because you also lose a lot of credibility amongst your peers when you have the name observer, so they don't think that, you know, you really are doing anything on your delegation, that you don't have influence. So that makes a lot of difference. I also think they just really liked making fun of someone from a country as powerful as the U.S. But we'll get there, I think. In the future, youth delegates will have a much more sophisticated role than I do. And I hope that I'll play a part in, well, I do currently play a part in making recommendations for how to improve the program.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Claire Boskin. I'm from the community as close as the next door. ever appreciative of these programs here. You offer such a broad palette of where youth can be involved. So I was particularly caught by the way in which youth can serve in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have particular areas where we can, quote-unquote, deploy youth to do what young people can do? Are there particular areas that are favorites of yours or most important to you?
There's really so many. Interestingly, youth are actually 2 times more likely than adults in the U.S. to volunteer, just
uh-huh.
both internationally and domestically.
Uh-huh.
So, like I said, the energy is there. But there's such a wide variety of programs, and oftentimes it's the case that young people are using the skills that they already have, which, as I mentioned, is often teaching English. I mean, that's the biggest demand across the world. It's a huge economic advantage for young people in other countries to learn English. There's also really a wide variety of different programs for young people to be involved in health programs. One of my favorites is actually for youth to be involved in is microfinance. I think microlending is really, you know, one of the most extraordinary innovations. And I had the opportunity to meet with Muhammad Yunus in September, who's always been one of my great heroes, especially since microfinance programs tend to target women, because they found out very quickly that women tend to spend money on their children and health,
yes.
whereas men in some countries tend to spend that money on other things.
yes.
And so, for example, in Bangladesh, 94% of the Grameen Foundation's loans go to women. So I love it when young people participate in those types of programs. For those of you that are maybe juniors or seniors, Kiva, the microlending program, has a fellowship program where they, as you said, they deploy youth to go and report back on Kiva's fellowship, the success of its microlending programs across the world. So I personally am thinking about the Kiva Fellow program for Tajikistan. And actually, those young people that have language skills, I mean, that is a tremendous skill in terms of participating in these types of programs. You know, the list just really goes on and on. And it's a good experience, I think, for a young person at any age. Many of you have heard the critique of Boston College's service programs in other countries. There's always sort of a tension between the students that go on Appalachia versus the students that go to Ecuador. I don't think that it's so black and white. I really don't. I think that my experiences volunteering and working in other countries inform the way that I participate in the ways that I volunteer in the U.S.
Yes.
I have been involved in Fort Boston working with the children of Somali refugees in Roxbury, and I don't think I would understand some of the things that they have been through if it weren't for some of the experiences that I've had. I think that I also spent a summer in Boston interning at the Suffolk County House of Corrections. And a lot of the young men that are in the correctional facilities are immigrants. And so I use my language skills quite frequently. It's really not that dynamic that, you know, it's somehow a betrayal of the challenges that we face in America to participate in international programs and vice versa. I just don't think it's, we're too interconnected to really look at things in that way.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Gabriella. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I have a question. So before your delegacy through the UN, how do you fund all those, you know, all of your mm-hmm. projects that you've done before?
That's actually quite possibly my favorite question that I get, because I think that there's, when I speak to young people, there's often a perception that somehow their possibilities in their life are constrained by their financial situation. And that the ability to travel is, you know, the luxury of a few, which it is. But at the same time, I think that there are so many ways that you can be creative as a young person in terms of fundraising. I mean, I've done so many really... there's something to be said for being 14 or 15 or 20 years old and requesting support for travel than being 40 years old. My mom, like, always says that, you know, there's not grants for moms to travel, you know? I mean, those don't really exist. She's really... and so I think... and so I think, you know, I mentioned the example of Iran. You know, I literally drafted a letter saying, you know, why I was interested in going to Iran and also what I could do for the people that contributed. I think that's an important aspect. People want to feel like if they're supporting you, that they're learning from your experience alongside of you. So, you know, I had a blog, I came back to Seattle and I traveled around to different chapters of the United Nations Association, and I talked about my experience in Iran. So I tried to bring the experience home, and that was a big factor that influenced people. One person sent me a check for $500, and they said, you know, this is my email, just, you know, please send pictures of your experience. They said, you know, I don't personally feel ready to go to Iran, but if you are enthusiastic about it, I want to hear about it. So there's really so many different ways, and also... BC is actually a very exceptional institution in terms of the travel and research funding that it offers. A lot of my friends, even at the Ivy League schools, were very jealous of the fact that I received a grant to spend 2 months in Turkey my freshman year. And they said, you know, we don't have any grants at Harvard, for example, that are like that. So BC can help you with that, too, without question. And there's been a number of other things at BC that have cropped up. I know the Clough Center now has a program. There's also a human rights type fellowship that BC is now offering for travel and research. But yeah, definitely. People are very surprisingly responsive to young people's enthusiasm for travel.
Yes. Yes.
I'm Kate Wasman, and I guess I would have to say the question of where am I coming from is a little more complicated, but I can say that I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and I've taught at BC in the political science department for a very long time. So I wanted to ask you a little different kind of question, which is, you mentioned two different kinds of differences of opinion. First, but among the youth delegates. So I wanted to know, sort of, what are the things about which they disagree most fundamentally? And then you also sort of described something of a generation gap between the youth delegates and the old fogies at the UN, and what are the issues on which there's sort of systematic difference of opinion between the younger delegates and their elders?
Actually, an answer to both of those questions would be climate change. The European youth delegates are extremely critical of the US position on a number of issues related to the environment, and they sort of channel those through me. And then also that there's also a generational difference on the sense of urgency about the issue. The German youth delegates gave a very stunning speech about climate change at the UN, and, you know, I think it really shook people. I mean, young people really recognize that this is an issue that's going to affect us in a very dramatic way, and we're just not seeing really substantive changes being made sort of in domestic politics in the U.S., but also at the U.N. Some of you may know Joseph Manning, who is also a junior at Boston College, who's the Sierra Club's youth delegate to all of the UN conferences on climate change. BC has supported him to go. This is a good example of BC supporting you to travel to Copenhagen and Cancun and Durban, and also most recently to Doha to participate in conferences on climate change. And he, you know, can speak about it better than I can, but this is really a central issue that the UN really struggles on getting binding commitments from its members on the issue of climate change. Recently, the youth delegates created a petition for the UN cafeteria to stop using plastic silverware, because even the UN itself, in terms of its building and the way that it operates, isn't a sustainable place. It's not a model for sustainability, to put it that way. So that's definitely an issue. And then also in terms of amongst the youth delegates, I think the question of social welfare and welfare programs for young people is definitely a point of debate. We also just recently, I was saying, got into quite a debate about quotas for women in the legislature in a variety of countries. And so I sort of sparked a Twitter controversy after we talked about that in our class. And so, you know, what's been very surprising to me is the extent to which part of participating in the UN is representing your own country's political system and having to sort of answer to that. Yeah. So I immediately this semester registered for a bunch of American politics classes at the university so I could, understand it better myself. But it's always very lively when the youth delegates get together. And also a question of what issues the youth delegates should focus on. Should we have a very narrow focus? Should we pick a few issues that we all work on together and we are all lobbying our delegations at the same time on the same issues, on the same proposals? Or should each youth delegate focus on their areas of policy interests that are sort of more in their wheelhouse? So how do we work together? Are we more powerful together than we are individually in our own delegations? Are a lot of the questions that we spend a lot of time talking about.
Good, yes.
Hello, good afternoon, Brooke. I'm an undergraduate student, an international student from Spain. I would like to know, before you were saying that being the US delegate means that you receive lots of criticism from Europe countries.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that being the US delegate means support all the politics from your home country. How do you manage when you don't really agree with some of the politics from your country?
This is a great question. I remember thinking, given my background, whether I was selected despite of my interest in the Middle East or because of it. I certainly, there are a number of issues that I don't agree with the U.S. delegation on, but it wouldn't be surprising to you that the delegation is not always in agreement. The State Department, I spent a week at the State Department in December during finals period, and it was very interesting asking the same question to all of the different bureaus that I met with and getting completely different answers. So I think the notion that you shouldn't participate as a public official because you don't share the views is sort of, to a certain extent, a cop-out. I think that it's important. I thought about whether I should participate in the delegation when I don't always share the views that the U.S. has towards the U.N. But then I realized that to walk away from this type of opportunity because of that didn't really make a lot of sense. And there's a lot of opportunity for dissent in the delegation. It's just not always public for a variety of different reasons. But also, I would say that I've had a lot of autonomy on the delegation. There have been very few times when when I've been asked to sort of, you know, retrain my focus, Iran comes up often as one of those things. I mean, I'm not privy to all of the things that are going on in the U.S. government related to certain issues, so sometimes there's a recognition that I don't want to interfere with that, but at the same time, you know, I tend to just sort of go my own way and apologize later, maybe, I guess. I think part of what a young person can do on a delegation is present a different view than the official position. I think that that's important, especially since the U.S. is just not always right when it comes to the U.N., to put it lightly. And I haven't really backed down from that. And I think that has hopefully gained the respect of the other youth delegates that initially were sort of skeptical. But
how big is the U.S. delegation?
I mean, the U.S. delegation is, of course, enormous, given the variety of different U.N. agencies. I mean, whether it's the mission in New York or in Geneva or in Nigeria, I mean, it's rather large. I mean, I personally have been to work primarily with the Bureau of International Organizations and the State Department, so that would be most closely with Ambassador Rice, but even more closely with Assistant Secretary Esther Brimmer. She's been the person that has been my most direct point of contact on a regular basis. But, you know, you can see the extent to which people will disagree. And then, you know, even outside of the State Department, there are so many other government agencies that have a variety of different priorities. And one thing that I would say about my experience at the State Department is I would give the example of, let's say, for example, that Secretary Clinton, former Secretary Clinton, I haven't quite accepted that, former Secretary Clinton is, you know, traveling to a country, and she is going to be in the country for 3 hours. Well, you have all these different bureaus at the State Department that compete with each other to say how she should spend those 3 hours. So you have the Human Rights Bureau saying that she should absolutely make human rights be a focus, and then you have the Economic Bureau saying, no, if we talk about human rights, then it will overshadow the economic priorities that we have in terms of trade. And literally, there's hundreds of different people that start, you know, engaging this debate about how she should spend her 3 hours. And then she can, of course, override all of that and say, you know, I'm going to meet with these civil society organizations, and this is what I'm going to do. So it's a big back and forth. Development is not on the same plane as diplomacy and defense in the U.S., in the scheme of the U.S. foreign policy. I think that's a big mistake. I think it's a problem. But I think that Secretary Clinton elevated development higher than it's ever been on the U.S. agenda.
We had one more question here. Yeah.
My name's Kathy, and I'm a senior at UC. And I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more in detail about exactly your, like, roles and responsibilities as a delegate, as well as, like, how this experience will shape kind of what you want to do after BC, or how it has already, or what you're thinking.
I think initially one of the most important aspects of the role was to gain the trust and confidence of the variety of different agencies and bureaus that sort of impact whether this role continues or not. You know, I've received understandably a lot of criticism about the extent to which I've been engaged on things like a listening tour with American young people. But something that we recognized very early on was that there was a lot of internal opposition to a youth delegate program within the U.S. State Department. And so I realized that the first thing that I had to do was build the confidence of the people that actually determine whether this role even exists, and also determine the extent to which I participate. If I hadn't done that, I think the role would be sort of superficial. But I sort of demanded that I would have meetings with a variety of different people when I was at the State Department and at the mission, and just making sure that people within the State Department were informed about what I was doing, because that's another issue. I mean, the State Department has 60,000 employees. How do you make sure that people at the State Department know that they're is a focal point on youth in the U.S. Delegation to the UN. You know, that was something that was really important to me, and I think building the trust and the confidence of the people on the delegation was important. I think it'll be extremely important for people going forward who participate in the program. And then, you know, we'll keep building on the engagement aspect in terms of with American youth. But I still have had a variety of different opportunities to speak to young people in the U.S. and also, you know, they're constantly engaging with me on Twitter and Facebook and things like that. But we need a more structured process for that. It shouldn't just be people that, you know, happen to live in New York or D.C. that that engage with me. You know, it should be something that even in really small towns and schools that really feel like they are aware of the program. And we're also talking about expanding the program. So having two or three youth delegates that have different policy specialization. I can't know about everything. And so it would be really, I think, great to see sort of a division of labor in terms of, since the UN is involved in so many different ways, even just familiarizing myself with the UN and the U.S. relationship with the UN is sort of was a lot of briefings that I did. Essentially, my first few weeks on the job was just constant briefing materials and meetings to make sure that I really understood the U.S.-UN relationship prior to assuming the role. And also, they're going to try to select the next person 3 months in advance instead of 3 hours in advance. Which will be a huge advantage for that person, whoever they are.
So tell us your Twitter feed.
It's at U.S. Youth Observer.
At U.S. Youth Observer. All right, good. It's on our website, I think, as well, the WASI Center. But I know there's lots more to talk about, but we need to let people get back to class and such. But please join me in thanking Brooke and welcome.